Thank you.
Lathery and others versus School Board Fairfax County, Daniel J. Smith, Matthew D. Staver, Appellant Counsel, Sona Rivari, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Matt Staver. My co-counsel is Daniel Schmidt. I respectfully request this court to reverse and grant relief to the plaintiffs. The school board below violated the Dillon Rule, and the plaintiffs are entitled to declaratory relief. The relevant facts of this case involve a school board that added three, perhaps even four categories to the non-discrimination.
Can we jump right into the question of standing? Because that's the
point. Yes. In fact, on the standing issue, you've got Jack Doe, the minor, and the parents. Jack Doe alleged in paragraphs 70 through 76 in the complaint that Jack Doe, because of these policies, is in fear of discipline, is in fear of personal safety, is in fear of invading
privacy. What is he doing that might justify that fear? In other words, is he under Tinker? Is he speaking on this issue? Is he in a club or whatever? I mean, what is the... We have this bare-bones assertion. How do we know that that's anything other than hypothetical?
Because he says, actually, that he's in fear of what he can actually say in the complaint. He says that it's unclear in terms of the parameters of these particular policies. And these policies are throughout the entire policy, including disciplinary. In fact, if you can imagine someone who's in their senior year and they want to go to law school, or they want to go to West Point or some other place that requires a pristine record, and now this policy is hanging over that student's head because of violation of this policy where they could be suspended or even expelled. That's so
the logical inference is speech is chilled, therefore standing.
Correct, as well as discipline, not just speech, but he's also alleged that he is in fear of actual discipline, where he could actually be suspended for either complaining, for example, that someone of the opposite gender is in the restroom or shower room or locker room, or even raising the question or even debating it. For those reasons, not only can he get suspended because of speech, but because he even raises this issue, he can be suspended because he doesn't agree with it or doesn't like it or ultimately resist it.
Counsel, let me ask you this, though. If he is in fear of sanction, wouldn't that be a basis for standing right there under 22.1-87?
Yes, it is. In fact, 22-187 is one of the causes of action. He has that because the policy there in the statute says...
But there's three requirements. There's got to be aggrieved. It's got to do it within 30 days. And then, of course, you'd have to challenge that it was without authority.
1-78 is what I'm talking about. 1-87 doesn't apply for several reasons.
That's what
reasons.
I was asking. Well, wouldn't it apply, though, if that's his concern? If he was, in fact, sanctioned, then he could certainly have a right of action.
That's not the exclusive remedy, and that's what the trial court below ultimately said, page 197, I think, through 201. And that's what was presented to the court by the school board on page 180-123 of the appendix.
I'm just asking because you claim that he had no remedy other than this declaratory judgment action, but he does in fact have a remedy if he is in fact sanctioned.
But again, if he doesn't have to wait for the sanction to actually occur. That's part of the declaratory judgment act. You don't have to wait for
but
that.
But he does have to be aggrieved. He does have to be aggrieved, doesn't he?
Under, if it was brought under that, but section 22-187 actually says that only applies if the action of the school board is within the authority of the school board. And that's quoted in the memorandum of law presented to the district on page 123 of the appendix.
Is there any limiting principle to your argument then? Let's say, for instance, the school board had a policy that everyone had to wear school uniforms. And he said, I'm nervous about that. I'm afraid that I'm going to not be able to get into law school if I express the fact that I don't want to be in a uniform.
Yeah, there is a limiting challenge, and that is whether it's void ab initio, whether it violates the Dillon Rule. There are a lot of things that the school board can do within its parameters. In that particular case, 187 does apply. But it's not the exclusive, even in that situation, because 187 is permissive. It has may.
So is the Dillon Rule an exception to our general standing law?
The Dillon rule is an exception to the 187. He has standing because of the fear of discipline. The plaintiffs also have standing because of taxpayer standing. And in fact, in all the Dillon's rule cases that I've researched, there was not a specific requirement for that particular taxpayer standing. It wasn't even focused on. What was focused on, although it may mention standing in some cases, in other cases don't even mention standing, what was focused on is the fact that it's void ab initio.
Well, don't all the taxpayer cases have to do with expenditures? What expenditures do we have here?
If you look at the appendix to the complaint, the expenditures are there on the face of the superintendent's letter.
Well, there's nothing in the complaint, not a word in the complaint about expenditures. You concede that, right?
No. I say that the actual attachment to the complaint with the superintendent said that they're going to transform all their policies, they're also going to do training, they're also going to implement disciplinary actions. That is expenditures that they're engaging in that they're doing in an ultra-virus way. I think this pulls it out of the 187 in the sense
don't
that...
Don't you have to plead that? How does that get into your pleading? How does that appendix get into your pleading?
We actually quote or cite some of what the superintendent says in the actual factual section of the complaint and then attach the entire letter that he sent out.
But you never allege taxpayer expenditure that I remember seeing.
We allege taxpayer standing.
Okay.
And the fact is, based upon what is attached to the complaint, it alleges or it shows that there is an expenditure. The school is going through a lot of work and machinations and redrafting their policies and implementing...
Let me ask you this question then. Would that expand the whole idea of expenditure so that any policy the school board tried to institute would cost something, I guess? They'd have to train somebody to do something. So would any school policy now be reached by taxpayers?
No, I don't think so. But I think the real difference here is whenever it's void ab initio, as it is in this case. The way that the
you keep coming back to that principle that somehow the Dillon's rule has made this a different case than
I think it does make it a
case
different case, Your Honor.
Because you have any authority for that?
Well, you cannot limit this Dillon's rule challenge to a 187. You can't limit that to an actual discipline because then you throw out 178. 178 says the school district has to operate in a way that's not inconsistent with state law. They clearly have not operated consistent with state law. They've added four...
Does that create a cause of action to give your client a chance to sue?
That creates a cause of action. In this particular case, standing because of the fear of the discipline based on that student's because of these new additional categories that are...
And what I'm trying to figure out is how far do we stretch the bare assertion of fear of discipline. I mean, for example, you have a student who says, well... I lead a Bible study, and you hear the materials, and I'm concerned about a collision between what I'm going to study and this policy. Or I have this club, and we debate these issues, and my concern is when these issues come up, I'm going to be subject to discipline. Or I use this bathroom, I have to share it with a student, and that's a concern. We just have essentially a bald assertion of fear of discipline. So how much can we read into that on the standing question?
Well, certainly at the Demur case, the Demur status, the judge below should have at least allowed an opportunity to amend. The court below, the standing issue that was relevant to the court below, in which the court got wrong, is that there was no standing because there had not been any discipline actually imposed. And that the only way that the plaintiff's minor student could challenge it is under 187.
Under Tinker and so on, it's pretty clear that you don't have to be subject necessarily to discipline if your speech or other constitutional right or statutory right is chilled or threatened. That can be sufficient to seek a judicial declaration as to the appropriateness of what you want to do. I'm just wondering if we're at that point.
I think you are at that point. I think you don't have to cross the line to actual discipline. But fear of discipline is enough. And that goes to the Tinker, what you're talking about. It goes
if you're finished with that, let me interrupt you this. Haven't you abandoned that assignment of error claiming that the trial court erred by not giving you a chance to amend? I agree with you. You argued that you preserved it, and I think it probably is preserved because the trial judge did say in his final remarks, I'm not going to let you have a chance to amend, but I'll consider you taking exception to it. But how did you not abandon it when you made no argument or no cite to authority in either your opening brief or actually your rebuttal brief?
Your Honor, I think we did preserve it, and in fact...
Okay, we're going to pass that. But how about abandoning it? Didn't you abandon it when you made no argument?
No, I don't think we abandoned it. I think what we did was we focused on the issue of the court just completely dismissing it across the board because of absolutely no standing and the sole remedy being 187.
Not only did you focus on that, you didn't say a word about amending. There's not a word in your whole brief about amending.
Well, under the trial court's rationale below, there would be no reason to amend. The only time, in fact, the trial court below said, the only time that you can come back is if, in fact, this is applied and you actually face real discipline.
But I think the question, if I understand Justice Millett, which is a question that I have you abandoned it here? Aren't you barred under 527 because you make no argument on it and you cite no authority that I saw?
Well, I don't think we abandoned it, but at the end of the day, to amend before the trial court will absolutely do nothing, because the trial court has this exclusive 187 remedy that is only available, and that is absolute discipline, not chill or fear of discipline. And so whether you amend it many, many times over, you're never going to pass what the trial court ultimately had as its rationale, and that is a 187. We focused on the substance of what the court ultimately came down on, and it was
187. So is your argument that you don't have to satisfy Rule 527 if it would be futile?
I think it's futile under that scenario.
What's the law that would support that you don't have to follow the rule of making an argument here?
Well, I would say that it's futile to actually amend under this scenario if 187 is the exclusive remedy, because there's nothing that could be alleged that would change the facts of this case other than the fact that something else happens and there's actual discipline imposed. And that's not what the Dillon's Rule requires. That's not what the Declaratory Judgment Act requires in terms of adjudicating the rights. Here we have plaintiffs, a student who fears discipline. He doesn't have to cross the line to actually be disciplined. It would be detrimental to his educational and his later career in life. But he fears real discipline. It's in the disciplinary code. He's restraining his actions, and he laid that out in the complaint. As a result of that, he has the right to be able to have his rights adjudicated. And what are those rights? Section 122-178, that the school cannot pass laws inconsistent with the state law. They clearly did. They've never justified that action.
Counselor, can I interrupt you a second? This seems to be inconsistent with Cupp. In the case of Cupp, the plaintiff actually had a right that he had to give up. He had a grandfathered use that he had to give up if he wanted to go through this process, and he might actually be in worse place than he was before. How is your client in worse condition now than he would be by simply waiting to see if he is, in fact, action is taken against him, and then if it is, he can certainly ask for judicial review under 22.1-87.
You know, when you fill out the bar application, have you ever been disciplined? Yes, he'd have to say.
Well, he was overturned, right? If it was overturned, he would say no.
But he's been the target of discipline. He's not required to actually be disciplined in reality or go through the hassle or the process of arguing against that discipline. That fear of discipline enough is his chill and his injury, in fact.
And then I guess I'll ask you again, I've mentioned this before, I guess, and I say, is there any limiting principle to what school policy can be attacked? And you say the only limiting principle is the Dillon Rule.
Well, I would say that Section 1-78 is a limiting principle. And Section 1-87 is also a limiting principle. And they both say the same thing in part. 187 says that only applies if it's within the authority of the school board. So if it's outside the authority, 187 doesn't apply. 178 says a school board has limited authority in that it cannot enact things outside or contrary to the state law. That's what the school has done in this case. Doing so, they have imposed a threat of discipline on the plaintiff. And in Cupp, I think, helps our case, because in Cupp, it wasn't actually applied. It was the fact that they argued that they had the power to engage in what they were doing. The school board argues that it has the power to act in this way and enact these additional categories.
But see, in Cupp, though, the litigant had to actually give up his grandfather status to attack the statute.
Well, in here, he has to give up his status of being able to operate under the state non-discrimination laws. Now he has to bring back and chill his own actions and face discipline for violating something in which the school violated the state law, and that action alone is void ab initio. That's what he's giving up. He's got a right under the state law. He's also got a right under the state law regarding privacy and constitutional right to education. He's having all of that interfered with because of these policies that avoid ab initio from the school district. I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sona Hawari. What is at issue here is a policy that says we as a school system will not discriminate and will not have our students harassed for a variety of reasons, including sexual orientation and gender identity. Only one of the four plaintiffs is even in the Fairfax County Public Schools. And there's no allegation.
Counsel, does the record reflect what year Jack Doe is within the Fairfax County Public Schools?
There's no allegation as to which school or what year.
Okay.
Other than it's a high school.
And within the pleadings themselves, are there any allegations relating to sexual orientation?
No, other than they challenge that.
All the factual allegations relate to gender identity?
Yes, his concerns about what these policies will mean. And there's no allegation that he is discriminating, wants to discriminate, is positioned to discriminate. There's no allegation there's something he wants to say and hasn't been able to say. There's no allegation about speech. The first we've heard about speech is today.
What if there were?
If there was an allegation that his speech was being chilled, I think you would have to give some specifics, and then there would be a constitutional right. But what we had was...
Well, there'd be constitutional standing.
Then you may have a constitutional challenge. They didn't bring this under a statute that protects his constitutional rights. They brought this as a common law right of action. There was no dispute. There was no statute and no constitutional provision that we were talking about.
So at what point in this gradation would he have standing on your analysis? Where he is now, according to you, is he's fearful, uncertain discipline, no specific predicate conduct. The next step down would be he's fearful, discipline is possible, arguably likely, and specific predicate conduct is alleged. And then, of course, the third tier would be actual discipline. At what stage, from your perspective, would standing under Virginia law give him the right to access to the court?
It's not discipline that makes the turn. It is a question of what is the right that's at stake. And so the gradation depends on what's the right at stake. If it's the right to be free of discipline, there is no constitutional right for that. There is a right to be
He's not filing a constitutional 1983 case.
I'm sorry?
This is not a 1983 case. He's filing a state law case asserting the Dillon rule in a state court. So the question is, under state law, what's the standing for being able to do that?
And under state law, there is no common law right. You have to assert a constitutional right. There is no common law right under Virginia law
to challenge
school board policy.
You have to assert a constitutional right to assert a Dillon rule violation.
You have to have a statutory... A Dillon rule violation presupposes a statute. A Dillon rule is a rule of statutory construction. It presupposes that there is a statute. The Dillon rule is not a common law right because it's a rule of strict construction for statutes in terms of statutory powers.
It's a little more complicated than that. That a local authority does not have constitutional power under the Virginia Constitution to act at all if there is a Dillon rule violation. So it's a Virginia constitutional violation which the Dillon rule draws the boundaries for. So the question is not Tinker so much, not 1983, not disciplinary actions under the state procedure. But if a student within a school has a grievance, there's going to be at some level where that grievance is going to qualify for standing. And what I'm trying to get from you is, are you saying, no, you're wrong, there's never a level. We'll shut them down at every single point in the allegations I just outlined, including actual discipline.
Unless the student has its own individual constitutional right, yes, there is no point unless you are at 22.187, because the General Assembly created school boards under the Constitution.
Okay.
And as part of its mandate under Section 1, it provided a system in which school board actions are not subject to review except under 22.187,
okay,
which requires a person to be aggrieved.
So if, in fact, Jack Doe were disciplined in some fashion after the policy goes into effect at his school, Would he then be able, for 30 days thereafter, to pursue his remedies under 22.187?
Absolutely. And under 22.187, one of the bases the court is to consider is whether the school board has exceeded its authority, which is a Dillon rule.
I'd like to stop there for a moment. Whether he has standing or not, is the first issue that we will reach. If indeed the court finds that he has standing, we then will have to address the Dillon rule question. And it would appear that the only factual issue or substantive issue in front of us is gender identity as opposed to sexual orientation. Give us your argument about how a policy by a local school board relating to gender identity is authorized by either the General Assembly or the Virginia Constitution. In other words, close the Dillon rule circle about why a locality can do that. So I think that's a real open issue right now.
Well, those are the merits of their claim, and while they were not addressed below, I'm prepared to take it up because they said their argument is that the reason that the school board can't do it is because 15.2-965 limits what can be contained in a human rights ordinance of a locality. Those are their claims 1 and 2. 15.2-965 on its face applies to a locality, which is defined.
I think their argument is broader than that, but they use the human rights statute as one further example.
And school board's authority to supervise the schools within their division is not limited in the code in terms of what a school board can determine is in the best interest of the students. 279.6 allows the school board to have student codes of conduct, which is what affects this student, that are more stringent than what's prescribed in the Board of Education's regulation.
How would, under your argument, a school board violate the Dillon rule with regard to its student code of conduct? Give me a hypothetical example that would help me to understand how this would not violate the Dillon rule, but something else would. Because I'm trying to figure out where to draw the line.
Well, it's student code of conduct that purported to govern student conduct that doesn't occur in the schools, for example. Someone might argue, well, that violates the Dillon rule because, you know, you don't have the right to tell me what I can do when I go home in terms of how I conduct myself. But even there, we know that, for example, the bullying statutes and the school board's authority to prevent bullying extends beyond the school board, beyond what happens on school grounds, because it covers cyberbullying. So there isn't a limitation that's been placed by the General Assembly on the kinds of things that school boards can protect students from. There's a lot of things that kids get picked on at school every day that you don't see in 15.2965.
It sounds like you've flipped the Dillon rule coin. I think I just heard you say, well, we can do whatever we choose to do that's in the student's best, we believe is in the student's best interest, unless the General Assembly has told us that we can't. The Dillon rule, at least as I understand it, is actually the opposite of that. You can do what the General Assembly tells you you can do. And so if, in fact, my formulation is correct, what is the authority for the General Assembly telling you that you can do this particular action?
The authority is the authority of school boards to adopt rules for conduct of their students.
And if indeed they say this is a rule of conduct for our students, then they have carte blanche to have any rule they choose to?
Well, you have to look at the rules. So the rule that they're challenging is a rule that says you cannot harass. And school boards have the authority to say we will not allow bullying, and they don't have to say, well, we need to go to, you know, we need specific authority from the General Assembly to say you can't bully a child because of their weight.
Is this particular policy limited to harassment and bullying, or does it go beyond that?
The student code of conduct, the only provisions that are challenged are that harassment. It's in the anti-harassment provisions. That was what was alleged, that you are not permitted to harass. Students will not be permitted to harass on any basis, including, and there's a long list.
So I've already looked at what the school board did, and I frankly interpreted it to go beyond harassment. But if I go back and reread it, I will find that it relates specifically and is very clearly limited to harassment.
There's a non-discrimination policy that is not limited to students, and it is what the school board will do. With respect to the students, the only provisions are harassment. It's in the student code of conduct. That's what he's saying he's in fear of discipline from, are the anti-harassment provisions. And again, you don't need a statute that says
He has indicated something beyond fear of discipline for harassment. He's also indicated essentially embarrassment or a harm to his cultural values.
But
that seems to be an allegation that goes beyond harassment, and that's why I'm trying to.
And it's an allegation that's based on a series of what ifs. What if there's a student at his school who is transgender? There's no allegation there's such a student.
Okay, you're just mixing up standing and the merits. I mean, we go back and forth. If the code of conduct is limited to harassment, and this allegation in this case is limited to harassment, then maybe the point's well taken, but it's broader than that. Now, the question we're here on, the standing issue, right? As I understand what you said before, if there is a Dillon Rule cause of action, it evaporates the moment there's an alternative statutory remedy that can be utilized. Am I right? There's no standing, unless you have a con law issue, which has nothing to do, a federal con law issue has nothing to do with what I'm asking about. There's no standing under state law to bring a Dillon Rule action if there is a statute somewhere that provides an alternative remedy.
And we haven't found, and they haven't found, a Dillon Rule action against a school board.
Well,
that,
just dealing with the statute. Yeah, but just dealing with the principle of the matter. Does standing under state law to file a state law Dillon Rule cause of action in a state court go away, evaporate, as a matter of law, the moment there is an alternative statutory regimen that might provide a remedy?
I think that presupposes that there was a Dillon Rule violation.
Okay, I am presupposing it for the sake of my question. Your argument is that maybe there was one, maybe there wasn't. It doesn't really matter because the statutory action supersedes it. So it's almost like a preemption argument for standing. And we rejected that recently in the Howe case. I don't know why we wouldn't reject it here.
No, and I want to clarify. My argument isn't that the statute trumps the Dillon Rule. My argument is the Dillon Rule presupposes it's a rule of strict construction of statutory powers, and the General Assembly created school boards under Article 8. They didn't exist at common law. So the question is, what did the General Assembly provide as to in terms of what should be, how can school board actions be challenged? And they provided a statute that carefully draws a line so courts are not in the business of second-guessing.
Doesn't your argument go farther than that? Don't you say, basically, the Dillon Rule is not a substantive law that creates a cause of action?
Absolutely. That is correct. There isn't. And we haven't found one, and they haven't found one. Yes, there are cases.
If I understand Justice Kelsey's question, is that it's not the particular remedy that we're talking about is not the exclusive, necessarily, remedy, but it's a remedy. Is that right? Or is it your position that discipline has to be imposed, and that's the statutory avenue is the sole way to go forward?
I'm not saying that the only way a person can be aggrieved is if there's discipline. You could have an aggrievement that is not discipline. There's other ways to be aggrieved.
Have we ever had a case law that says that aggrieved includes being nervous or possibly embarrassed about the possibility of the enforcement of a statute? Do we have any case law that supports that argument?
No. What the case law says, and it was undisputed below, that they were not aggrieved, that you need a unique burden. If there is a unique burden on this...
It was undisputed below that they were not aggrieved?
They yes.
did not make an allegation of aggrievement?
They did not. We argued they're not aggrieved within the meaning of this court's case law as to how that word is used in that statute.
They
said
agreed
no.
They agreed with your argument?
They did, because they said, we're not moving under 22.1.
Well, that's, though, you see how circular this conversation is? So what? Their whole point is 22.1-87 doesn't matter. So they're not agreed. They are agreed. They can win. They can't win. It doesn't matter to their argument. Their whole argument is that there is a standing concept. It clearly applies to Dillon Rule challenges. It doesn't depend on a statute. And their claim is that their allegations get high enough to just barely get over the edge of what that standing requirement is. But I hear you as saying, no, we're not doing it. We shouldn't do any analysis because the statute is the beginning and the end of the equation.
If I may respond, my time is up, but if I may respond.
Absolutely.
And my point is that there's no cause of action. We have not found one, and they have not found one, that there is a cause of action, because if this Dillon Rule claim exists, what is the source of it? Because as I understood this court's opinion in Cherie was, it has to come from Virginia substantive law. There's no statute, there's no constitutional provision. We have to find it in the common law. And the common law does not find you a single example of a Dillon Rule claim against the school board to challenge a policy when school boards didn't even exist at common law. And so the General Assembly, and you can contrast 22.187 to the Administrative Procedure Act, in which the General Assembly gave people who are affected a right to challenge an agency rule, in addition to people who are aggrieved by a decision. And if they wanted to do that with school boards, they could have done that, but they haven't. And, you know, we can go into the list of reasons why that makes sense, but we have a very different scheme for how school boards are to implement their Article 8, Section 7 authority to supervise the schools within their division.
All right, thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Counsel, let me jump right back to the standing issue. I tend to be the standing Grinch of this court, having asserted that neither the Speaker of the House nor the Majority Leader of the Senate had standing to come into the court on a certain matter early last year. The way that I hear your argument is that if, in fact, a potential plaintiff is making a Dillon Rule argument, therefore void ab initio, that they only have to show a scintilla of injury or even less than a scintilla of injury, perhaps the possibility of future injury. That is a rather, that's a troubling limiting policy, limiting principle.
I wouldn't say that. I want to also mention something that you said. It's not just gender identity. In 105 and 106 of the complaint, it mentioned sexual orientation as well.
But then there are no factual allegations relating to sexual orientation. But I can go back and look at the complaint and
sure.
Try to interpret it. But I want to hear the standing is the troubling aspect to me.
The standing issue here is you've got a school board that violated the Virginia Human Rights Act by adding additional categories. 1-78 does not give them that right. 1-87, which is what they rely on, what the lower court relied on, says
so that only that's a policy issue. That's not the standing issue. That's the substantive issue.
The standing here, those are the statutes. The standing here, however, comes from the fact that as a result of this Dillon Rule violation, the plaintiff, the minor plaintiff, is in fear of discipline. And that's a real issue. And the Declaratory Judgment Act allows this court to reach impending threats to an injury that are not ripe yet. And that's what we have here. We have threats.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Yes.
What's the impending threat specifically?
The impending threats are the fact that these are now in the disciplinary code and throughout all of the policies and procedures.
But impending means impending, like it's right there, it's threatened. Is there an allegation of that?
There's an allegation that, in fact, because of these, at any moment, Damocles' sword could fall down on his neck, and he would then be the subject of a disciplinary proceeding. He doesn't have to cross that line, respectfully, to have standing. But because these are in the disciplinary code, and because the superintendent actually promulgated these and issued a letter to make sure that these are implemented in a disciplinary manner, that's where he has the standing, because of the fear of that disciplinary action. Now, if the Dillon's Rule doesn't apply and 187 is the only remedy, that would allow a school board at the end of a semester to enact a policy that is clearly outside the Dillon's Rule, outside state law, inconsistent with it. 30 days go by at the semester end, and then they come back to school, and they have these policies that threaten...
But as soon as it's been imposed upon a student, that student has standing to challenge.
But the student doesn't have to actually walk across
the disciplinary... That's your argument. I understand that.
I think the fact, Your Honor, I see I'm out of time, but the fact that disciplinary actions... That this is in the disciplinary code, sexual orientation, gender identity, and also gender expression and even gender identification. And that could happen at any moment based upon what he says or does. That alone is enough to give him standing. He has a concrete injury that would be redressed by openly declaring his rights, and that this is inconsistent with state law, and it's inconsistent with the authority under Section 22.1-78.
The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.